Hey everyone, and welcome to this Risky Business feature podcast. I'm Patrick Gray. Listeners may have noticed that I'm a little less welded to a strict format for the show these days, and mostly that's because the sheer volume of news we have to cover these days is so much larger than what it was when I first started Risky Business. Increasingly, we just don't have room in the main weekly show for feature content, so more and more, I'll be breaking that out into these separate podcasts. And in this breakout, we're chatting with Adam Boileau about the talks that caught his attention in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago. The Black Hat PR team were kind enough to credential Adam for the con so he could go and see a few talks with his Risky Business hat on. I was at the con, but I spent most of my time running around like a headless chicken. These days, Vegas week for me is, really mostly about locking in next year's sponsorships. The good news is that's done, and we are almost sold out across the weekly show, Snake Oilers, and Soapbox until 2020. The bad news is, of course, that I didn't really get to any talks. But that's okay, because Adam went both to Black Hat and DEF CON, and he joined me to talk about the highlights from his point of view. This was his first trip to the Vegas cons since 2005, a fair bit's changed since then, but he agreed with me that the content this year was actually pretty bloody good. Here's Adam.
Yeah, I thought it was quite a good lineup this year, and they had a lot of content, which is, of course, one of the challenges with Black Hat full stop, right? They have so many tracks, and this year they had broken out, the regular talks. They had a whole other section just talking about tooling called Arsenal, as well as, sponsored talks by some of the vendors, plus all the vendor areas. It was a real, a whole bunch of content available, and I picked a path through the bits that seemed interesting to me. And yeah, there was a bunch of really good stuff, and as someone who's now worked in the industry for a long time, it was perhaps more relevant to me as a practitioner than, some of the more hacker-friendly talks at DEF CON. You can kind of starting to see, I guess, a bit more differentiation in the audiences between the two.
But to be fair, it was your first time there since 2005, right?
It is a long time since I went. Yes, so
that's it is. Now, look, I know you were really impressed by James Kettle's presentation. James works for PortSwigger. He was actually on the show talking about some research. I think that was last year. But they did something interesting on sort of, web apps and cache poisoning.
Yeah, so James Kettle's talk was, I think, certainly one of the outstanding ones for me at Black Hat this year. A really great example of, the kind of hacking where it's not technically super sophisticated, but the impact is amazing, and the reason that he was able to do it was, really through kind of a clarity of thought, like thinking about things in the right way. So, a great example of hacking at its best. His talk was about web cache poisoning and kind of mechanisms by which you could force the update of web caches in front of important things and use that to attack them. And the techniques that he were using really was just, kind of like using crafted headers to kind of encourage the cache to cache content in a way that it didn't really expect to, and then leverage that to, change the contents of pages, to redirect login pages, to, introduce cross-site scripting. And actually, one of his examples of his technique, he'd attacked a system that deals with configuration of Firefox extensions. So he poisoned the web cache at Mozilla in front of this particular service that, all the Firefoxes in the world reach out to every kind of half hour or so to configure some extension-related stuff. And through that, he could, in the end, get Remote Code Exec on every Firefox in the planet at once.
Nice.
Impact-wise, pretty wow.
Yeah.
The content in that case was signed, but he was able to, for example, provide an older revision of the configuration files that were signed but were for a vulnerable version of some extensions, and then, kind of leverage that to gain Code Exec. So that was a multi-step process. But, the impact is still, pretty important that, you're able to poison caches in all sorts of places. He had a bunch of other examples of, injecting injecting code. One of his other examples was the Drupal 8 CMS, and indeed anything else based on the Symfony and Zen frameworks, where you could just, straight up cache poison in front of those. His example, of course, was, change the login page to post the credentials to you. Drupal fixed that bug, I think, a couple of weeks ago now. If you haven't patched your Drupal, maybe you might want to consider that one.
I'd imagine this is something that you're going to use on a red team, right?
Yeah, it's a really sweet technique. And I mean, it's a thing. I mean, web cache poisoning is a thing people have done in the past. But I think the thing James brought to it there was, you know, sort of a, just a clarity of, you know, structured thinking about how the cache makes a decision about what the cache and where that cached content is used. And then, of course, because he works at PortSwigger, he's gone ahead and added detection of this particular stuff straight into Burp. So indeed, every pentester that uses Burp will probably start finding a few more web cache poisoning things popping up in their active scanner tab, and you should totally pay attention to those because they're a big super deal, useful.
Yeah. So what's the remediation look like for them? Is that pretty straightforward?
So, I mean, in this case, it was like filtering headers and things that are used to influence what gets cached to make sure that the caching policy kind of matches all of the important attributes of your application. And I think, unfortunately, that's not a great recommendation, because what it means is you have to kind of tune your cache right to match the application that you're serving. And, you know, where, as we're seeing in a lot of cases these days, that caching infrastructure, you know, is in a CDN or it's in a third-party component you might not have, you know, a whole bunch of configurability over. Like, it is a pretty fiddly thing. And, you know, this is one of those, it's going to require attention to detail to fix. So I think we're going to keep on seeing this kind of thing for a while.
Yeah, yeah, that is a good one. Now, you also went and saw Sean Metcalf talking about Active Directory. And, you know, you said this was like a more like an overview, but a really solid one of, you know, architectural level Active Directory issues.
Yeah, so I'm sure Metcalf, for those of you who don't know him, runs the very good adsecurity.org site that has a whole, you know, sort of encyclopedic set of information about Active Directory and its security issues. His talk was kind of around, you know, some of the aspects of modern Active Directory security, you know, things like, you know, segregating your administrators off into a separate forest and using one-way trusts to permit trusted administration. So, yeah, a real kind of roundup of, you know, issues around that kind of thing, issues around privileged access management, solutions that, you know, allow you to manage privileged access accounts programmatically rather than having the users manage their credentials, and ways you can attack those, countermeasures. So yeah, anyone who's got kind of like a mature AD environment where they've been really trying to do things, you know, a bit better than the average bung everything in one domain, you know, and hope it's all fine kind of model, it's probably worth going and having a look through the slide deck and kind of making sure you're looking at some of the things that he's got there, in particular, you know, controls around service accounts, the level of privilege required for those, and the sorts of things that just splitting all of the domain admins off into a separate forest doesn't solve, because for a lot of people that really is quite a major undertaking to implement a separate administration forest, and there's a whole bunch of things that you still got to get right in the original domain, you know, even if you have pulled out all of the privileged domain administrator level users.
So this would just be a good one for CISOs listening to track down and get familiar with.
Yeah, and also, I mean, yeah, AD architects, anyone who's involved in large-scale Windows network design and review, because, you know, everything on the planet runs on large-scale Windows networks, and it's really important to get this stuff right, because it's so, you know, AD is so complicated, and there's just, you know, there's a lot to keep in mind. And Microsoft's advice is, you know, sometimes a little bit obtuse on the subject, and Sean's work is quite good at explaining it in a more, you know, palatable manner.
Now, something a little more niche that caught your eye was some research into LTE networks.
Yeah, I went to this talk by a guy called Altef Shaikh from the Technology University in Berlin, and it was talking about an aspect of LTE mobile networks. There's a feature of LTE networks called self-organizing networks, where when you're rolling out your cell network, you can kind of delegate a bunch of the more tedious radio management to automation, so you don't have to have, you know, expensive radio engineers, you know, fiddling with the layout of your cell networks all the time. And if you're on a carrier where this kind of self-organizing stuff is turned on, and, you know, I'm not 100% clear how, like, what range of carriers actually trust this stuff to run their networks for them on the radio side. But yeah, his research was into kind of disrupting that self-organizing behavior, you know, through a bunch of technical means. The main ones he was talking about was essentially standing up fake cell sites that don't have enough cryptographic key material to participate in the real network, but can still influence the self-organization process to, for example, force reboots of legitimate cell sites, which takes out the network for a while, or forces end users to migrate down to, you know, 2G or 3G connections that might be more easy to attack through other means. Things like hijacking a call handover to drop calls, and then also, you know, that having that result in reorganization of the network to your advantage. I mean, the net result would be, you know, kind of denial of service more than anything else, but for mobile networks, like, that's still a really big deal. And being able to kind of target this a bit geographically, and to a certain extent to particular users, was a really interesting kind of idea. I mean, the core guts of it being that the cell network is making, you know, network level organizational choices based on, in some cases, data provided by handset devices or data coming from cells that may not yet be, cells that are not legitimate but are still standing up in the right place and the right frequency. There's even over-the-air auto provisioning of cell sites, which you didn't really go into, but that sounds like a thing that might be fun to play with as well.
Yeah. So, you know, we've spoken about something of interest to you know, web app testers, then CISOs and Active Directory types, then telcos. And we've got another one here for the ICS people, which is, you know, there was a Black Hat teardown of Trisys. This is the real nasty ICS malware that disables safety controls. There was also a talk at DEF CON on it, but you went and saw the Black Hat one. How was it?
Yeah, this was a really cool talk. It was, I think, three people who'd all worked in ICS security for quite a long time, you know, kind of talking through A, the Trisys malware, B, the kinds of systems that it targeted and the like safety instrumentation systems in industrial facilities. And then they did a bunch of work reverse engineering the actual malware, reverse engineering its comms protocols. The thing I thought was really great was they wrote their own payload for it. The Trisys malware was one where we never saw the real payload, like we saw the spreading mechanism, the infection mechanisms, like the way that it attacked the safety instrumentation control systems, which, as they pointed out, are kind of like the last line before you have explosions. But we never saw a real payload. So they actually wrote their own payload, which they demoed during the talk, which was pretty fun. They also had a really interesting observation, which I think got a little bit lost in the rest of their talk, which was why we didn't see it actually, like, Trisys actually work in the real world, like why we never saw its end game target, because it was clearly quite an expensive, you know, piece of malware, and, you know, we never knew actually what it was for.
It was for an industrial control. I think it was for a chemical plant in Saudi Arabia, wasn't it?
Well, it was for something.
That was the scuttlebutt anyway. But yeah, they do have a bit of speculation on why it didn't work, and it's hardly reassuring, right? Actually just a demo. Like, it seems like they just made a mistake.
Yeah, so I mean, they made this point that in the piece of malware, there's loads of like printf debugging, where clearly the people who are writing it, you know, went through a long iterative process of making it work. And they enumerated all of these debug messages. And one of the things that they noticed, having worked with a bunch of this gear over their careers, was that there was nothing to do with one particular architectural feature of some of the higher integrity ICS control systems, where they've got multiple CPUs that have to agree. In this case, the TriConnex components that they were looking at had a feature which TriConnex called, I think, LSX, which was this kind of multi-CPU voting thing. And there were no debug messages about this feature. And they speculate that when run on one of these devices, the payload just didn't work, or the malware didn't work. And the fact that there were no debug messages about that suggested that they hadn't thought of that particular thing, which I thought was an interesting, you know, sort of an interesting observation.
Well, and just dumb luck that people weren't killed by this malware, right?
Well, I mean, that too. And obviously people will have learned this lesson. But yeah, I just thought it was a novel kind of way to do, you know, to infer what might have happened by what wasn't there.
Yeah, so there you go, Iran. Maybe you want to have another crack at that, or hopefully not, because killing people with computer viruses is bad.
It is.
You also saw, and that was Marina Krotofil, and two of her colleagues who did that talk. You also saw a talk from Mordecai Guri on jumping air gaps, and I know that jumping air gaps is a topic near and dear to your heart, Adam.
Yeah, this was such a great talk. We actually have covered some of this set of research over the years on the show.
This was like the air gap jumping omnibus, right?
Yeah. We talked a couple of years back about one of the demos from this particular crowd where they had used a machine that is air gapped away from the real network and a cell phone nearby, and they were encoding data to be leaked from the compromised air gap machine into FM radio transmissions that they were generating off the bus and then picking up nearby with a cell phone that has an FM radio chip. And this talk was like kind of a collection of this kind of various side channels to leak data out of air-gapped environments. And they did like optical and infrared and ultra high frequency sound that you can't hear. And they did the FM one. And then they went onwards to do like low frequency magnetic fields coming off the CPU, which they detected through a Faraday cage, like a Faraday room environment. And it was just a complete compendium of different ways to do this kind of crazy stuff.
Did you walk away from that one with the impression that crossing air gaps is a lot easier than people might realize?
Well, yeah, certainly exfilling out of an air gap clearly is has a lot of options available to you, especially if you've got other gear in physical proximity. You know, air gaps have some value on the, from the going in perspective, but the
exfil side, yeah, once you've got control there.
Once you got control, yeah, clearly there are a whole bunch of techniques, some spookier and more hilarious than others that you can use to get data out. And that's certainly a thing people should keep in mind when they're air gapping.
Now, one that I'm really disappointed I missed was this screaming channels talk. This was where basically by using some software-defined radio kit, you could, by measuring sort of jitter in signals coming from Wi-Fi gear or whatever, you could infer key material because people's, digital processing was on the same circuit board as their antennas. So you could sort of infer the processing that was taking place behind the scenes and extract key material. Did I get that broadly right?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I also missed this talk and I was sad about it because I had to make a hard
choice. I remember we spoke about it and you're like, well, either they've done this or they haven't. So let's just wait and see. And it turns out they have, right?
Turns out they totally had. No, they had some demos which were, they were using, I think, like Bluetooth Low Energy Kit and then leaking key material, like AES crypto key material out of it by measuring the perturbations of the RF that these devices were transmitting and then doing that, quite a lot of times to kind of average out the noise levels and things. And yeah, in the end, recovered enough information to get key recovery.
Was that just Bluetooth range, or was that Wi-Fi as well?
So they demonstrated it against Bluetooth LE, but they have, it's a general kind of class of problem. And they say that they've got a couple of Wi-Fi devices, which they're kind of working on, which exhibit the necessary properties of kind of coupling between the analog front end and the digital equipment that's on the same SOC. So yeah, it's a general class of problem. And we will probably see more research, against other devices, other than just Bluetooth.
Ben Delpy, the creator of Mimikatz, was talking about some updates.
Yeah, I went across to go see that one. Ben Delpy's, always great value. And, of course, Mimikatz is an amazing tool. He was there talking about one of the new features that they've implemented called DC Shadow. This is a set of techniques for post-compromise scenarios where you've already got, privileged domain administrator level access, and then basically standing up a fake domain controller and having that replicate changes into the real Active Directory. Essentially, you get the ability to update the contents of the Active Directory database, kind of directly at the underlying database layer without going through any of the front-end logic. And that's got a bunch of things that are useful for attackers to think about, things like being able to modify the contents of the database without touching like the last modified time, or being able to make changes that, normally the front end logic wouldn't let you have. One of the examples he gave there was, when you've got multiple different types of auth in Windows, Kerberos with different levels of AES, the NTLM hashes, being able to modify the different sorts of hashes independently of each other. So you can end up with a user account where, in an environment that's relatively modern and everyone's using Kerberos with AES 256 crypto, you can leave the AES 256 key alone, but update, say, the NTLM hash so that you, the attacker, can use older, less secure forms of auth and log into the account without actually breaking the access of the real user. So a whole bunch of that kind of...
That's beautiful.
It is. It's a beautiful thing, right? And you can just see all of the incident responders, and forensics people in the room just kind of like rubbing their temples delicately as they thought about what that meant. But yeah, it's certainly like once it's in Mimikatz, people are going to use it. And for post-intrusion, shenanigans and persistence, being able to just kind of like add yourself to the SID history, add the domain administrator level access to the SID history for your account, which doesn't show up in the regular, kind of members of domain administrators group. Like, there's all sorts of stuff like that. That's just, as an attacker, super, super useful. And as a responder, just, oh God, the pain, the humanity.
Yes. lots of temple rubbing, as you said. Now, there's look, I'm gonna combine these last two into just sort of one discussion blob, if that's all right with you, because we've seen some interesting stuff involving NTLM and also like SMB, and these are abbreviations that, like, you know, they're some old abbreviations, man. What's new here?
Yeah, so I went and saw a talk about updates to the MANA toolkit from the SensePost guys. Dominic White had some of the work that they'd been doing to implement NTLM Relay or MS Chap Relay support into rogue access points. The idea being you could stand up an access point near your target's, you know, BYOD rubbish Android device that doesn't check the certificates of the enterprise EAP, and then relay that onwards to the real network. The gain access, which is a pretty cool extension of, you know, the sorts of thing. I mean, we've been doing NTLM relay on the wired side for ages, but having that working in the wireless environment is pretty cool. I was surprised because I thought this wouldn't work because there's a bit in the standard called crypto binding that's meant to tie the wireless credentials to the the auth credentials done during the EAP, but apparently no one turns that on, which I was, you know, outraged in the audience at, because I had looked at this and gone, it'll never work. Yeah, you know, let's leave that one alone. But no, it turns out totally works.
And the glory could have been yours, Adam. The glory could have been yours.
But yeah, no, they did it and it works, and that's really cool. The other Windows auth thing that I went to look at was a talk by William Martin about his tool SMB Betray or SMB Tray.
This one picked up a bit of buzz, man. I sort of caught a bit of buzz on this one.
Yeah, so it's a great example of one of these tools where, you know, we kind of all knew that it was possible, but there wasn't a practical tool to do it with. This implements his tool implements kind of man in the middle on SMB file sharing. Windows, you know, SMB file sharing. In the normal case where there's not more sophisticated SMB security, it basically means that you can get in the middle through, you know, ARP or DNS or, you know, last resort multicast or whatever, of a, you know, client computer connected to a file server. And at that point, you can see all the files, which we could already do with, you know, kind of a Wireshark or something, modify, you know, contents of directory, contents of files. You know, one of the examples he gave was a tool has a mode where you can just replace every file with a Windows link that runs a binary of your choice, you know, which gets you a shell. But the thing that he did that I think was most interesting was he also went through and implemented SMB signing. So in modern Windows, it's recommended that you turn on SMB signing, which prevents this kind of modification on the wire. The most recent version of SMB 3.1.1, which is what you have if you've got a Win10 client talking to a server 2016 SMB server. In that case, there's also encryption, which, you know, kind of makes this not work. But in all other cases, you can get in the middle. And in the case of ones that do require signing, if you know the credentials of the end user, you can derive the signing key and then also continue to man in the middle despite the presence of signing. So it's kind of a niche tool in a way. I mean, like the non-signed scenario is genuinely useful. I mean, anyone who's done, you know, man in the middle, anyone who's in a position to do man in the middle Windows boxes is going to find it super useful. But if you're in the specific scenarios where you've got SMB signing in play, this is a really interesting, interesting piece of tooling. And whilst you probably could have done it, you know, kind of bodged up with some MPACKET or with some Samba, you know, having a hacker friendly tool that's ready to go, you know, makes the theoretical practical, which is, you know, what hackers love. So if you're a Windows pen tester or you're a hacker that likes the Windows, it's certainly worth checking out this tool, having a read through the talk, trying to wrap your head around, you know, why Microsoft would design SMB signing like that. I mean, to be fair, it was a long time ago. And yeah, if you can deploy the SMB 3.1.1, the most modern release with Win10 and 2K16, really, you absolutely should, because it's just so much better than the earlier ones. Like, despite being a minor point release kind of version number change, it's significantly different from a security perspective. And yeah, you know, if you're sitting on the fence about your Windows 10, Windows 27, 2016
deployment, let this give you a push in one direction.
Yeah, pretty much. You should go pull the trigger on that, on that upgrade and get rid of all of the nasty XP.
Those last couple were DEF CON talks, weren't they?
Yes, yeah, those ones were DEF CON. There was certainly some good content at DEF CON this year. I went to less talks there, but there was certainly some, you know, some solid things.
All right. Well, Adam Mann, thank you so much for going to all of those talks while I was running around like a headless chicken and getting minor surgery at 2 a.m. But certainly, certainly do appreciate it. And it was, you know, it was great to hang out with you over there and actually catch up and spend some time together. That was all really good. And yeah, we're going to speak again in a couple of days for the next weekly edition of the Risky Business Podcast. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I had a great time in Vegas and Black Hat. It was great to meet a whole bunch of listeners as well. We had a good time meeting some, you know, putting some faces to the people on the other end of the podcast. And yeah, I look forward to talking to you all again in a couple of days.